Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications at TryLifeMD.com? We're now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
It's fun to put on jeans that you couldn't get into 6 months ago.
Every morning, I look forward to getting on the scale.
For anybody who's struggling with their weight, it's a godsend.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
Alrighty then. Hello and welcome to the Monster Legends Podcast. I'm your host, Tanner. I hope you had a fantastic week this week. I certainly was busy. I had worked 10s Wednesday to Friday. And I am tired. And I had to work Saturday as well. So I am beat. And I had just woke up and did some research today. So I was so busy. First podcast. What is going on today? There's a lot of stuff going on with the coronavirus. Everybody buying up all the toilet paper and hand sanitizer. But don't worry, you'll be fine. Just don't freak out, people. In this week's episode, we are in Massachusetts. Known for the Red Sox, Patriots, and I'm not sure what their basketball team is. What is their basketball team? Look at the... Oh yeah, the freaking... Celtics, yeah, the Boston Celtics. Yep, had a really great team in the 70s. Okay. Let's talk about these little creepy places, but first, there's a place, like a Bermuda Triangle place in Massachusetts called the, I forget what it's called. Something Triangle. Let's read about it. Let's read a little bit about it. The spot isn't easy to find. It's only by crab walking across stones and painfully ducking under the rock that forms the ceiling of King Philip's cave. You can rest in a spot where Metacomet, the chief of the Massachusetts one of Pananogs, likely spent one of his final nights. The leader was slaughtered by one of his own men and beheaded by English settlers in 1678. In a war that pitted Algonquin Nation against the white settlers. Such a lovely spot, you almost forget you're in a quiet neighborhood full of upper middle class houses in the quiet Boston suburb of Norton, Massachusetts. But there's an un- undeniable chill in the air. The Rock Formation is one of many such sites in the 200 square mile area of the South Whiskey, Massachusetts, local to paranormal enthusiasts called the Bridgewater Triangle. That's right. A mystical swamp zone within commuting distance of Boston. For centuries, locals have reported strange activity in and around the swamp, from Bigfoot sightings to Native American ghosts, strange orbs that weave through the trees, UFOs, unmarked black helicopters, satanic rituals, and cattle mutilation. In 1980, Boston Magazine reported that Police Sergeant Thomas Downey spotted a 6-foot-tall winged creature while driving late at night on a country road. Some paranormal aficionados asserted that this was the mystical Thunderbird. Prominent in the local Native American mythology around the same time, famed cryptozoologist and folklorist Lauren Coleman, dude, I'm gonna talk to him so bad, brought wilder attention to the area and its spooky reputation in his best-selling book Mysterious America. In it, he traced an area from Albion, Rehoboth, and Freetown, encompassing the swamp and surrounding towns, delineating the visible borders of the triangle for the first time. The Hockomock Swamp, an enormous swath of marshland that comprises the single largest freshwater basin in all of Massachusetts, was the final holdout for Medicott and his warriors in the days leading up to the annihilation by the English. By the end of King Philip's War, nearly 3,000 Wampanoag men, women, and children were killed or sold into the slave ships bound for the West Indies. The landscape is dotted with stone monuments to their lives here. Their ghosts have morphed over centuries into foreboding fairy tales of fantastic creatures and feigned entities that tell us more about the ancestral guilt and paranoia of the conquerors than the natives themselves. Profile Rock in Freetown, a natural granite formation resembling a human face, watches over the woods. Locals claim that the natives believe the face to be an image of Chief Massasoit, Philip's father, who was friendly to the newly arrived English. Today, crude graffiti mars the walls of the sacred cliff face. A few miles away, in the hamlet of West Bridgewater, at the base of a wooden bridge, is hidden the Solitude Stone. Lost for nearly a century beneath moss and overgrowth, the stone bears a 150-year-old inscription thought to be carved by the Reverend Timothy Otis Payne of the New Church of Jerusalem, a Christian sect founded on the principles of the occultist Emil Swedenborg, whose philosophies purportedly influenced Freemasonry. In his doctrine of correspondence, Swedenborg asserted that the physical world was the result of spiritual causes, and the laws of nature's reflection of spiritual laws. The mysterious inscription reads, "All ye who in future days walk by Nookatus stream, love not him who hummed his lay, cheerful to the parting beam, but the beauty that he wooed in this quiet solitude." Perhaps the most interesting spot in this area is the Dieton Rock. People of unknown origin carve figures of people, animals, and symbols in the flat side of the trapezoidal boulder, roughly the size of a small Volkswagen. The origin and meaning of the markings has been subject of debate for centuries, with theorists attributing the petroglyphs to people as various as ancient Native Americans. Phoenicians, Norse, colonial Portuguese, and even medieval Chinese sailors. In the 1950s, a stone was removed from the river by crane and deposited on the shore, where a museum was built around it. Today, a small but knowledgeable fellowship of local citizens runs the museum and even organizes lectures exploring the history of the area and the theories surrounding the stone and its markings. The museum is open for self-guided tours by appointment only. On this particular day, I am not called for an appointment. Crestfallen, I was ready to quit the woods when I encountered two women, one rolling hurriedly in an electric wheelchair along the wooden road. They told me that they were friends of the Dighton Rock Museum and they happened to have a key. They were kind enough to help me set up an appointment with the Park Service. The woman in the wheelchair didn't buy the single origin humdrum. Personally, I think it's from a multiplicity of cultures. I agreed to meet them in the next morning. By the way, I want to say I is a person who wrote this from AtlasObscura.com. Okay, it's a week, huh? Crazy. Alrighty, let's get to it. Next day, I was allowed to spend an hour with a stone. Indeed, the markings seem to signal a mismatch of cultures, with geometric shapes and humanoid figures that recall Paleolithic paintings from Australia and Central America, as well as a formerly striking representation of a deer and a seal. These primordial images come niggle with etches that appeared almost modern with a Roman letter R and F, clearly defined as the center of a stone, which may very well be colonial graffiti. But what has inspired theories that the markings are proof that the lost Portuguese explorers or even Vikings made it to the New World? One theory from the 1700s states that the ancient Phoenicians have markings after marking it to New England shores engraved of stone with images from their cosmogony, with the past, present, and future represented simultaneously in symbol-strewn vignettes that bleed into one another on the tide-facing side of the stone. If you look closely, you can find the most recent carving, a signature made in the 1920s by a guy named Jesse, a friend of the Dighton Rock Museum, although careful to preserve an air of suspended judgment, cannot help but offer their own theories. Human figures on the left, they say, is a symbol of femininity and fertility. The symbol representing an X with an upside-down V above it that say symbolizes separation. As far as I know, the theory is definitive, says Ramona Peters, director of historic preservation for the Massachusetts Winnipeg tribe. There is one theory saying that the Chinese left the artifact. They would use this language of the people they were hanging out with before, which accounts for the European letters on the stone. Another favorite theory, heard around the appendix in public lectures at the Dighton Rock Museum, posted, was this: the stone is the last record of a doomed Portuguese expedition to the area, which ended with a violent confrontation with the local native peoples. The carving, they say, was a historic record left by survivors of the doomed expedition. The symbols do not speak to us as much, offers Mrs. Peters, and by we, I mean our tribe and other native people. We don't have petroglyphs in our culture, but the symbols here are not familiar. Figure representation and watch art, like the human form depicted on a stone, were especially uncommon. The people, she says, did not put themselves above other things. It's cool. So, that's pretty interesting. Brent Switzer wrote this article about the mystery of the Patton Black Flash, some mysterious universe. So shout outs to him and his hard work. He wrote it on August 18th, 2016, or maybe late before that. Maybe it got published on the 18th. You know what I mean. It was published on August 18th, 2016. Okay. A common feature in the world of the strange and paranormal is that of the phantom being. Throughout history, there have been various stories, tales, and reports of bizarre, mysterious, shadowy figures that seem to lurk just beyond the periphery of our reality. Dude, why you mix the words? That's so hard to say. Sometimes, like, perfect. I can't even say it. To only make themselves known when they wish to instill a terror within our hearts. These shadow people and phantom figures seem to have renewed themselves into our collective consciousnesses. And they are reported in both reality and myth across cultures. Sometimes threatening, sometimes merely creepy, but always frightening. They are undeniable. Beings are difficult to classify and what seems to have stepped right out of our nightmares. One of the most enduring cases of such a phantom intruder is an intimidating, ominous, black cloaked figure that stepped forward from such dark places to terrorize a small town in Massachusetts, and which has remained a wraith, perplexing mystery to this day. It all began in October of 1939, a town of Provincetown on Cape Cod, Massachusetts, in the United States, where frightened children began returning home from night with a scary story to tell. They claimed to have seen an extremely tall figure dressed in all black, which would appear out of nowhere to growl anonymously and to disappear just as suddenly, in a flash. Some of these reports claimed that the thing had a hideous, deformed face and glowing eyes. Whatever it was they were seeing, the ghoulish phantom certainly terrified them, and children were known at this time to come home crying and shaking inconsolably. Yet, as obviously upset and shaken as these children were, the adults did not take it all very seriously. After all, this was the Halloween season, and it all seemed like just over imagination or someone playing a prank with a Halloween costume. Then one night, a woman named Mary Costa was walking alone along shadowy streets past the city hall when she claimed that an impossibly tall figure, around 8 feet tall, had leaped out of some bushes to loom menacingly in front of her. A thing was described as having long, pointed ears and glowing eyes, which it used to calmly stare at the frightened woman for a moment before rapidly fleeing the scene in a series of inhuman, incredible leaps and bounds far beyond what a person should have been capable of. Costa claimed that she had run into a nearby coffee shop excitedly telling people about what she had just seen, and that some men had gone out looking for the mysterious intruder but had found nothing. Man, so that's creepy, right? Freaking dude, just walking down the street, and you're like, he pops out like this really tall guy, person, thing, whatever. Pops out and stares at you for like a second, and it runs back. It's like, it's like jumps out like Tigger, a really creepy Tigger. I don't know. Bad jokes. I'm sorry. I'm just horrible. Anyway, okay, let's get it. Although police did not take this report very seriously at first, it was soon followed by similar accounts by other adult citizens. In all the cases, a shadowy apparition which was claimed to be dressed in all black, complete with a flapping black cape and to possess glowing eyes that were either red or silver, as well as long pointed ears that were sometimes said to be of a silver color. It was also said that the weird buzzing noise, like a very large insect, occupied it. Others said it would let out a malevolent, unsettling laugh that was described as having an unearthly timbre and tone. It's also known for being extremely fast and agile, as well as for its purported superhuman jumping ability, with witnesses claiming that it could easily leap over high fences and can jump over 10 feet in a single bound. Curiously, police would often get different reports from different areas of known practically at the same time, suggesting that the thing was either incredibly fast, could somehow teleport, could fly, or there was more than one of them. While most of these encounters involved the mysterious dark phantom merely staring or terrorizing witnesses before bounding away, something it seemed to take a great pleasure in doing, others were sadly more harrowing. In one case, a man named Charles Farley claimed that he had actually shot at the creature and hit it, but that had been totally unfazed by the gunshot. Simply laughing maniacally? For nimbly jumping over a high fence with a single leap. Another man reported that he had seen, had suddenly confronted and cornered by the entity, had instinctively thrown a punch at it. The being was claimed to have caught his fist in his own hand and then proceeded to crush the man's hand, breaking it before hurling him to the ground effortlessly, as if it were an unwanted toy. Yet another such violent encounter happened when another witness claimed that a creature had lashed out to strike him. This breathtaking superhuman strength sent him flying through the air, and there were other adult males who also reported being easily overpowered by the apparition. Others even more far-out accounts claimed that the thing had shot blue fire at them from its mouth. Before long, the town had indeed other areas were buzzing with lakes of what people were starting to call the promised town phantom, the black phantom, the phantom feed, the devil of the dune, and the black flash, which was the name that the media would go with and would become the most popular name for the bizarre spectral thing lurking about. Instead, there were a variety of sensationalized reports of the black flash at the time in newspapers and on radio newscasts, which alone, with the increasing number of sightings, really whipped people up into a panic fever. Speculation ran rampant on what it could be, with some saying it was just a prankster or peeping Tom. Others say it was some sort of supernatural entity, such as a ghost or demon with an insuperable agenda not of this world. Some particularly religious folks thought it was the devil himself. Making things even worse were the bizarre and unsettling events orbiting the whole Black Flash fiasco. This was not let on after the town when the 1938 Orson Welles CBS radio broadcast of the War of the Worlds was aired. On Sunday, October 30th, 1938, sending many parts of the country into a mass frenzy panic. Okay. Further causing stress and uneasiness was the onset of World War II and looming shadow of violence inexorably pulling America in, which seriously weighed on the nation's mind at the time, as well as the devastating effects of the Great Depression. There were various other world weird goings on at the time, the immediate era as well, such as news of the sea monster that washed up ashore near World End and later be identified as a rotting basking shark. As well as that of a serial arsonist who had terrorized the town in this. Okay. Town in September before the appearance of the Nomic Black Flash. All of these converging events no doubt caused the Black Flash story today to pulse, grow, and become sensationalized with its various elements embellished and exaggerated with already over-dramatized news reports, radio shows, the era where it took on a life of its own in the middle of a populace whose imaginations were primed and their nerves frayed. The story typically goes that the Black Flash would supposedly go on to torment the people of Promised Town for 7 years, with reports going all the way up to 1945. In one such incident from November of 1945, a group of police officers apparently saw the phantom leap over a 10-foot-high fence after they went to a schoolyard to investigate a series of sightings there. The following month, a group of children claimed that they had been attacked by the Black Flash and escaped into their house to seek refuge, where they cowered as it banged on the walls and rattled doors. One man, by the name of Louis Genard, allegedly got a hot pan of boiling water thrown at the creature, which sent it screaming off into the night and would mark this as probably the last reported incident of the Black Flash. These incidents up to 1945 are written by the researcher Joe Citro in his book Passing Strange, where he claims they were crowned by him by the folklorist Robert Cahill, who wrote of the Black Flash in a book called New England's Mad and Mysterious Men, in which he says the phantom terrorized Provincetown for years. These details provided by Citro and Cahill have been widely referenced for stories on the Black Flash, but there have been some disagreement with this timeline. According to one of the foremost researchers of the Black Flash phenomenon, paranormal researcher Theo Podgims, sorry, pronounced the name wrong. This timeline is false, and he claims that these are details added later. The Cahill's work was substantially embellished, and the Black Flash really only struck for a few weeks for vanishing. He wrote a heavily researched article in 2007 for Anomaly Journal and Merit States and said of his finding, "I found the original accounts of the Promise and the Provincetown advocate, and with the help of these accounts, I was able to reconstruct a clear timeline to overthrow and throw out a large lot of the stuff that had grown into the Black Flash over the years. But it was clearly fabrication. One of these inaccuracies was the timeline, as the Black Flash did not strike between 1938 and 1945, as is often alleged, but only for a few weeks in 1939. Whatever timeline is correct, the question still remains, what was the Black Flash? Many theories have been proposed on the answer to this. Has not gone unnoticed, the Black Flash was in many similar ways to another murderous phantom that had allegedly terrorized parts of Great Britain in 1837, a phantom known as Spring-Hill Jack. These are several similarities between the two entities, such as glowing eyes, a black cloak, and the startling ability to make enormous leaps and bounds. This has caused some to suggest that the Black Flash and Spring-Hill Jack were one in the same, or that they were the same sort of entity, but it could also mean that some details from reports were embellished or added to make it seem that way. Indeed, the relentless sensationalism of the case at the time, and embellishments, additions, and exaggerations made over the years since then, as well as the substantial lore it has accrued and surrounded itself with, have made it difficult to separate fact from fiction when it comes to the case of the Black Flash. Even researchers on the phenomenon can't seem to agree on what really happened or how long it lasted. Other ideas are that it was some sort of mass hysteria or collective delusion, with the media hype and spooky stories escalating until it had everyone in its grips, or even it was some sort of demon, ghost, or vampire.
I'll tell you about the Spring-Hill Jack. I'm getting to England.
Oh, yeah. Georgia.
Stretching. Oh, God.
You having fun?
We're going to be here for a minute, so bring it. Tucked in, very comfortable. What you doing? Okay, we're fine.
Again, with all the embellishments made and everybody's taking with the tale in the news at the time, and through rich oral tradition since. It is hard to know what part or details of the stories are even real, so it's hard to say how much merit any of these ideas have. There is simply no real concrete evidence that favors any one of these. For these parts, everyone... Yeah. For the parts, authorities at the time were certain that it all stemmed from a malicious prank, although news of the Black Flash was everywhere, and many believed it was a real mysterious apparition. It seemed that actually a lot of people in the Provincetown itself incurred that it was most likely jokesters or Peeping Tom. Chief of Police Anthony Tevers even claimed that have known who the perpetrators were and how they did it. According to Tevers, it was four local boys who were playing
a look at Halloween tricks to scare everyone, and he had accomplished it by one boy standing on another's shoulders and then covering themselves with a large black cape and wearing a mask. Two sets of boys were claimed to have coordinated their costumes and appearance in order to make it look like they were teleporting or dashing with preternatural speed around town. Tavros also said they had even gone so far as to speak with the alleged culprits and their parents, and this is why the whole phenomenon had ceased. However, he did not release the names of the perpetrators, and no one has ever claimed responsibility for the supposed hoax. A statement made by Travers was also apparently not even really an official police pronouncement. The Black Flash potent jumping ability, agility, strength, and toughness, and other reported powers aren't really addressed with this theory either. This has led some to suspect that Travers merely making up the story to calm people down or to cover up what's really going on. In the end, we have no way of knowing for sure. In the end, it is unclear to the Black Flash what the Black Flash was. It isn't even really clear which elements of the story are true, which are complete fiction, or even how long the phenomenon actually went on for. The story has been picked up and written about in numerous articles and books. It's often give different or even conflicting, contrary information. With all the tales and the mishmash of misinformation out there on the Black Flash of Promisetown, but all we can say for sure is that something was terrorizing the town in at least 1939. What that was, whether a prank, a mass illusion, a ghost, demon, alien, or vampire, or something else altogether, no one really knows. You probably never will. And the mystery of the Black Flash will likely remain in the shadows within the realm of speculation, even as its legend grows.
Ooh, spooky, scary. Spooky, scary skeletons. Where's
it? Man, Cape Cod. Cape Cod mosquitoes.
Dude, I've been, like, binging the crap out of, like, Motion Radio. This is a podcast with, two wrestlers from Chattanooga, and they talk about sports and, like, geek stuff, and they come out, like, every Monday and Thursday, I think. It was great. It's really funny. It's really interesting. They were, like, I think they started way back, I think they started last year or somewhere before that, maybe before that, but, they start making, like, every week to do like a NFL picks for games, and it's funny listen make picks for games post haste, especially with Green Bay, because I'm a Packers fan and poor Dolphins, huh? That crappy 1970s fucking defense they have. Okay, so next up we have the Beast of Truro. Who or what is Truro? Is it a mountain lion preying on local pets and livestock? A dog or a pack of dogs? An ocelot? A lynx? A wildcat? Or some yet unidentified creature? The purported beast, Cape Cod's answer to Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster, has been a major topic of conversation news articles since last fall. This is an article from 1982, by the way, from New York Times. The first evidence that some unknown predator was loose came when a dozen dead cats were found in the same area in Truro in September. 2 weeks ago, a 175-pound hog was so badly mauled, its flanks ripped by deep claw marks and a chunk of flesh ripped out of its neck, that it had to be killed. A few days later, two pigs were clawed in their pens in another part of town. Initially, the culprit was thought to have been a dog or a pack of wild dogs on the loose. Then people started reporting seeing a large furry creature that they did not recognize. Others heard strange noises in the night. The most dramatic description from William and Marcia Medeiros of Truro. They said they were taking a walk about 3 months ago on a bike path near Head of Meadow Beach in Truro. An animal appeared 50 feet in front of them, definite long rope-like tail. Mrs. Medeiros continued, "My husband put his arms out to stop me. He said, 'You see what I see?' Together we said, 'It's not a fox.' It had very definite long rope-like tail, like the letter J. It hit the ground and went up. We figured it was about as tall as up to our knees and weighed 60 or 80 pounds. We were frightened and froze. He was in the path and didn't see us at first, and as we made some noise, he turned and we saw his face with short ears. Mr. Medeiros left the path to get a branch to protect him. The creature did not rush for cover, but you said walked slowly and casually along the path in front of them before disappearing into the nearby woods. The Medeiros are sure they saw a mountain lion. What we saw for the description, said Mrs. Medeiros. At first, the couple was reluctant to report what they had seen. Who would believe it? Mr. Medeiros said. Others have reported hearing strange cat-like cries in the night. Edward Ocelot, a Truman selectman and health officer, and said a New York man called in mid-December to say he has seen something resembling a mountain lion in North Truro. Mrs. Ocelot and seashore officers have made its efforts to identify the culprit by its tracks near the pig pens. But in the sandy soil, they could not find no clear impressions. Mr. Oswald said the general consensus is that the head beast is a dog or dogs, but I don't know if you can put that together with what happened. Could it be a mountain lion? That seems far out, but it's not impossible, he replied. Reports on mountain lions. Records on mountain lions. The mountain lion, also known as a cougar or panther, is said to be the largest cat in North America. Males can be 6 feet long with a 3-foot tail and overall length of more than 9 feet and weigh more than 200 pounds. Records indicate the last known mountain lion in Massachusetts was killed in 1958. Experts believe the eastern mountain lion is probably extinct. Truro is seen as an unlikely but not impossible habitat for a wild creature such as a mountain lion. 7% of the town is undeveloped land, part of the Cape Cod National Seashore. Packs of wild dogs occasionally kill deer in the woods. There is enough small game and domestic pets for wild animals to subsist on. Donald Roadhaven of Wellfleet, who formerly worked at the Bronx at St. Allen Zoos in New York and is familiar with the habitat of wild animals, says the mode of attack most suggests a cat than a dog. Dogs do not slash like a cat, he said. Many have left by camper. Mr. Roadhaven said he believes that so-called beast of Truro may be a mountain lion, ocelot, or lynx. They may have escaped or was left behind by a summer camper. Both mountain lions and ocelots are for sale, he said. The official view in Truro holds that the attacks on the pigs were by a dog or dogs. Thomas Kane, Truro's assistant town clerk, said, "I think it's a figment of imagination. People I know, people whose opinions I respect, think the damage was done by dogs. At one point, they were talked that the beast was a fissure. Finally, it got so ridiculous that I ignored it. Others, however, expect that the beast to tracking it." Alright, let's go next. Probably mountain lion. Came wandering in the Truro area. Well, let me think. Let me know what you think. Leave comments. Let me know in the Facebook group. You can find it on Facebook. Just find a link to the Facebook group at facebook.com/monsterlandspodcast. By the way, join, get updated on stuff, or follow Twitter. the monstrous sea serpent of Glosher. What could it be about? It told me of a sea serpent, or a snake. It lay coiled up like a cable upon a rock at Cape Ann. A boat passing by with English on board, two Indians, they would have dropped the serpent, but the Indians dissuaded them, saying that if they were not killed outright, they would be in danger of their lives. Report by John Jocelyn in 1638 was one of the early signs of an animal that would haunt the coast of New England, especially the coast of Glosher, for more than three centuries and be seen by hundreds of people. The report is of a creature that science says does not exist, a sea serpent. The harbor of Glosher, Massachusetts is located just north of Boston on the lower part of Cape Ann, which juts out into the Atlantic Ocean. Glosher has always been a seafaring town. Its harbors is well protected from Atlantic storms, making it a destination for ship sailing cargo. In the 17th century, fish abandoned off the coast, ready to be caught by enterprising and brave men willing to go to the sea in boats. If any group of people should have been known Sorry, if I keep talking. If any group of people should have known to be in local inhabitants, it should have been the fishermen and sailors of Glosher. Obadiah Turner reported the following incident of a similar creature off Lynn, Massachusetts, 3 years later. Some being on ye great beach, gathering of calms and seaweed, which have been cast thereon by ye mighty storm, did spy a most wonderful serpent, a shorty way off from ye shore. He was big around, and he thick as part as wine pipe. And did not affirm that he was 15 fathoms, which is 90 feet, or more in length. A most wonderful tale, but ye witnesses be credible, and it would be of no account to them tell an untrue tale. We have likewise heard yet keep, and ye people have seen a monster like unto this, which didn't here come out of ye land, which much to ye tear of them, ye did not see them. Although sea serpent incidents occurring occasionally off the coast of Cape Ann and the rest of New England during the 17th and 18th centuries, it went until 19th century that the arrival of sea serpent off the coast became a nearly seasonal phenomenon. The real big action started in August of 1817 when two women claimed they had seen the creature swimming into the harbor. The same sea serpent was seen at almost the same time by the captain of a coasting vessel. A few days later, Mrs. Ominous Story said she saw what appeared to have been a tree trunk washed up on the rocks of a town island, which lies in the harbor. As she watched it through the telescope, it moved and was looked again. It was gone.
We all know real life can suck sometimes, and your boss accidentally seeing you in your underpants on Zoom last week doesn't help any.
That's why reluctantly codependent sisters, the Shira and Rishalia, keep you enthralled and in stitches every week with their podcast, Legendary Africa.
Every Monday and Friday, we take you on a journey of mythical lands, magical objects, and monstrous creatures, both ancient and modern.
Find Legendary Africa on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and wherever you feed your ears. And remember, stay safe,
stay sexy,
and stay legendary.
William reported seeing a creature, saying his head was as broad as a horse or more so, but not quite as long. Same day, Anonymous Story also said saw the creature. It was between the hours of 12 and 1 o'clock when I first saw him. Said he continued in sight for an hour and a half.
I was standing on the shore. It was about 20 rods from him. When he was nearest to me, his head appeared shaped much like that of a sea turtle, and carried his head from 10 to 12 inches above the surface of the water. His head, at the distance, appeared larger than that head of any dog I have ever saw. From the back of his head to the next part of him that was visible, I should judge to be 3 or 4 feet. He moved very rapidly through the water, I should say a mile or two at most, in 3 minutes. I saw no bunches on his back. On this day, I did not see more than 10 or 12 feet of his body. 2 days later, on August 12th, Shipmaster Solomon Allen III saw the Gloucester Sea Monster surfing. His head formed something like that of a rattlesnake, but nearly as large as the head of a horse. When he moved on the surface of the water, his motions were slow, at times playing in circles and sometimes moving straight forward. The creature was even shot at 2 days later by ship's carpenter Matthew Gaffney from a boat. I had a gun, and I took good aim. I aimed at his head, and I think I must have hit him. He turned toward us immediately after I fired. I thought he was coming at us, but he sunk down and went directly under our boat. It made its appearance at about 100 yards from where he sunk. A captain also mentions the motion of the creature through the water as was vertical, like a caterpillar. There were 18 sightings of the sea serpent that year. Most from Gloucester, but a few from different parts of New England. Most of the reports were very similar. A snake-like creature, 60 to 100 feet in length, the head of the size of a horse and the body of a diameter of a barrel. Observers noted that the creature swam with a vertical motion, and his body appeared as humps behind him. Observers noted that the creature swam with a vertical motion. Okay, it's this report from Clifford Cheever Fletch aboard the United States schooner Science. Its color is dark brown with white under its throat. Its size we could not accurately ascertain, but its head is about 3 feet in circumference, flat and much smaller than his body. We don't see his tail, but from the end of his body to the farthest perimeter was not far from 100 feet. I speak with a degree of certainty, but by being much accustomed to measure and estimate distance and length. I counted 14 bunches on his back. The first one, say 10 or 12 feet from his head, others about 7 feet apart. They decreased in size towards the tail. These bunches were sometimes accounted with, sometimes without glass. Mr. Malborn counted 13, Mr. Blake 13 and 14, and the boatman the same number. His motion was partially vertical and partially horizontal, like that of a freshwater snake. I have been much acquainted with snakes in arterial waters. The motion was the same. Reports of the New England coast continued strong through the 19th century. 12 sightings in 1839, 9 in 1875, and 13 in 1886. Total of 190 for the whole 100 years. Sea serpents reported became the first fewer in the 20th century. A total of 56, and most of those before 1950. So what was the monstrous sea serpent of Gloucester? Most such reports are attributed to simply misidentification. Dolphins leaping in a single file might look like a series of humps. A 16-foot-long elephant seal might look like a sea monster to someone unfamiliar with a giant seal. In many of the Gloucester reports, though, observers first felt they were viewing something quite normal, but then changed their minds when they got closer. Opposite to what you would expect in a case of misidentification. For example, this report by John Brown, published in 1817. I discovered something about 3 or 4 miles distance, about 2 points on the weather bow, which appeared to be appeared as a mass, as it rose and sunk in a particular manner, once in about 8 or 10 minutes. I kept the vessel directly for it, and after looking at it with my glass, I observed to my mate that it was a wreck. As I could see timber and freaking up, etc. Second up. But as we approached nearer, I found what appeared to be like timbers to be a number of porpoises and black fish playing and jumping around a large sea serpent, which we had supposed to be the mast. Some sea serpents reports are hoaxes, either perpetrated by individuals or in many cases by newspapers. Hoax journalism is an art which was alive in the 19th century, but has almost disappeared today. While many of the reports have been found through period newspapers, others show up in private letters, which indicates that they were not part of a hoax journalism story. Even in the case of newspaper stories, many of the references to the Gloucester Sea Serpent seem to be like a kind of sensationalism that was often a part of hoax articles. So how do we explain that many times at Gloucester, along with the coast of New England, was there really a sea serpent swimming along the shores? The idea that there might have been such a thing as a sea serpent is not a process as it is sound at first. We continued. Awesome place. We certainly know that millions of years ago, at the time of dinosaurs, ruled the land, giant marine reptiles, some 80 feet in length, ruled the seas. Some people have suggested that in some versions of these creatures managed to survive the great extinction at the end of the Cretaceous era that killed dinosaurs. They think that the snake-like body reported might be a long neck of a Lamasaur or the back of a Mosasaur. The Gloucester sea serpent might not necessarily be Cretaceous left over, although plenty of sea snakes are alive today living in tropical waters. While these are much smaller than any sea serpent reported in New England, one water snake does nearly reach the sizes mentioned, the anaconda. Anacondas live in South American waters and have been reported at up to 37 feet in length, the girth of a telephone pole. Well, that's big. They most certainly live in fresh water and rarely venture into the open sea. However, it is so incredible to believe that there might be a cousin of the anaconda, which is twice the length in diameter and lives in the open sea. If the Gloucester reports are genuine and accurate, why are there so few in the 20th century and almost none in the past few years? J.P. O'Neill, author of The Great New England Sea Serpent, theorizes that the degeneration of the once fertile fishing areas off of New England by overfishing may have caused the creature to find another place to eat, or even go extinct. Ironically, that would have meant that 100 years ago there was once a population of sea serpents, but now they are gone. Last sightings in New England was off the coast of Marshfield, Massachusetts in 1962. There were no reports in the 1970s or 1980s at all. For careful protection of the fisheries, though, hopefully the population of fish may rebound. Will that be in time to help the Gloucester sea serpent? Assuming, of course, that this creature really existed at all. Perhaps there is some hope. In 1997, after over 3 years of silence, a report came from Fortune Bay, Newfoundland. It turned its head and looked right at us. All we could see was its neck 6 feet long, a head like a horse, but his dark eyes were on the front of his face. Perhaps the sea serpent is not dead, but just waiting to turn to his summer feeding grounds near Gloucester Harbor. Wow, that's cool, yeah. One of our freaking thing was quarterback of Patriots. Are you free to know? Where are we going? I might go to Titans. I don't know. this to freaking into challenge yesterday. I was at work. Man, it's so cool. Big Marion, so good. Hope she's doing all right. Turn some. Buck Wudgies, myth or monster? Okay. Sorry, I'm taking a break. So I need a co-host, man. You're talking, my voice is. Yeah. Take a breather every once in a while. You know? Okay. How you doing? How's your weekend? How's your week? Let me know on Instagram or Twitter, whatever. Facebook. Let me know how your week went in the Facebook group. Find a Facebook group on the page on the podcast Facebook page at facebook.com/monsterlegendspodcast. Once again, that's facebook.com/monsterlegendspodcast. Make sure you say it. Okay. Anyway, the southeastern corner of Massachusetts lies Bristol County, an area known locally as the most haunted place in New England. The injury that sleeps there has been rumored to cause haunted schools, ghostly armies, and unexplained suicides and murders. Forest areas of the area. Forested areas of the country have long been known to contain lightly of unexplained animals, from Bigfoot and Thunderbirds to large snakes and odd bear-like creatures. For the past 40 years, calls have flocked there, and their activities, often criminal, have filled the blotters of local law enforcement. All the unknown horrors that live in Bristol County, the most feared is not animal or ghost or the member of a snake or cult. I walked the forest, but a demon only 2 feet high. And the history of the era represents the history of our American society. These Pukwudgies are goat keepers of our darker side. The Pukwudgies have haunted the forest of Massachusetts since before the first European settlers even thought about setting out for a new land. For centuries, they tormented the local Native Americans and creeped their way into creation myths and oral history. They could easily be passed off as legend, and in fact, their physical description is much like mythological creatures from other cultures in other times. The difference is these demons jump from the page and evolve as people around them changing from reluctant helpers to evil tormentors. The difference is these demons are still seen by people today. Most cultures' mythology have reference to small monsters that have a strained relationship with humans. And in many ways, it makes sense. While large monsters have their places in our fears, the diminutive creatures find their way into the shadows of our rooms and under our beds. Their names, nature's chains, but there are always common threads that link them together. Some are called monsters and roam the land looking for human food and kidnapping anyone they can find. Others are called demons, foul spirits that feed off the negative and expose the sins of man. Referring to one, its clarification gets blurred, and these two worlds become interchangeable, perhaps showing us how closely associated these monsters are with evil. Veterans returning home after World War II talked of gremlins tearing apart their planes or getting to jeep engines and causing havoc. Hindus speak of the Rakshasas or the Night Wanderer.
who eats human skin and jumps into the dead to possess them. Africans tell stories about the Aloko, who lure people with beautiful music and want to devour them after they have been bewitched with an even ever-expanding jaw. Ooh, it's creepy. Reminds me of that one episode of Smallville, when that girl was freaking out, shakes number like 10 with the mirrorites, and your jaw like drop down. It's freaking awesome. I'm not sure who that was. This villain was not. Although passed off as a week's works of fiction, imagination, trolls and dwarves have existed in people's fears for centuries. They have become lovable and noble now, but the original stories of these monsters are anything but fairy tales with happy endings. Trolls are notorious for ambushing travelers and destroying whole families on a whim. While some are described as giants, humps, and one eye, many older cultures, especially in Scandinavia, describe them as being the size of a plump child. Dwarves have always been small, and their manners much better, but the end result seems to be the same. Like the troll, they are known as metal and stone workers, but unlike their fleshy counterparts, dwarves seem to avoid human contact. While they would prefer to be left alone and impeded upon their work, they become like caged dogs. One variation of the dwarf is a Tommy Knocker, who lives in mine shafts and is sometimes said to be the ghost of miners who have perished in the line of duty and are doomed to work for eternity. They are known to cause cave-ins and fires in the shafts. Perhaps the most famous of the small nightmares are seen by the Irish. Fairies patrol roads in Ireland, causing problems for any traveler who stays straight from the path. They live in hills or mounds and dance around fires. If a human comes across their mounds or sees their dancing, they are caught and held captive. Even a beloved leprechaun was once a malicious spirit before he was Americanized and transformed into the gold keeper he is today. Exposure to nature seems to feed these tales. And the more society depends on the earth for its needs, the closer relationship people have with the natural world around them. The more of these stories pop up in this country, the people the first settlers found had a close, not friendly view of small dangers around them. Cherokee have a mirror image demon known as the Nuni Dojonsti. Our little people that look and talk like Cherokee, but only a few feet high and have long hair that touches the ground. Although most people cannot see them, they are known to throw objects, trip hunters, and abduct people who wander off. In Canada, they are known as Menegishi, look like the classic alien gray. The Wampanoag Nation's dominant Native American tribe in Massachusetts and southern New England had a monster who still dominates the landscape they once roamed. The Pukwudgie made its first appearance in the oral folklore of the people of Cape Cod, but recent sightings have forced people to rethink their mythological creature. Standing between 3 feet tall, the Pukwudgie looks much like a modern idea of a troll. His features mirrors those of the Americans in the area, but the nose, fingers, and ears are large, and the skin described as being gray and or washed out, smooth, and at times have been known to glow. What makes these creatures dangerous is the multitude of magical abilities they use to torment and manipulate people. They can appear and disappear at will, and are said to be able to transform into other animals. They have possession of magical poison arrows that can kill and create fire at will. They seem to often be related to a tall, dark figure, often referred to in modern times and shadow people. In turn, the Pukwudgies control Taipai Wakans, which are believed to be the souls of Native Americans they have killed. They use these lights to entice new victims in the woods so they may kidnap or kill them. and European folklore, these bowls of energies are known as will-o'-the-wisps and are said to accompany many paranormal occurrences. Modern paranormal investigators call them orbs, and catching one on film is the gold standard of field research. Legends of the Pukwudgie began in connection to Mushwap, a creation giant believed by the Wampanoag, to create most of the Cape Cod. He was believed by the people, and the Pukwudgies were jealous of the affection they had for him. They tried to help the Wakpuk, but their efforts always backfired until they eventually decided to torment them instead. They became a mischievous and aggravated the natives until they asked Quaint Mushup's wife for help. Mushup collected as many as he could. He shook them until they were confused and tossed them around New England. Some died, but others landed, regained their minds, and made their way back to Massachusetts. Satisfied he had done his job, and pleased his wife, Mushup went away for a while. In his absence, the Pukwudgies had returned. They again changed their relationship with the Wampanoags. They were no longer a nuisance, but began kidnapping children, burning villages, and forcing the Wampanoag deep into the woods and killing them. Quant again stepped in, but Mushup, being very lazy, stepped his five sons to fix the problem. But Wampanoags lured them into a deep grass and shot them dead with arrows, with magic arrows. Enraged, Quaint and Mushup attacked as many as they could find and crushed them, but many escaped and scattered throughout New England again. The Pukwudgies regrouped and tricked Mushup into water and shot him with their arrows. Some of them said they killed him, while others claimed he became discouraged and depressed about the death of his sons. Mushup disappeared from the Wampanoag mythology. The Pukwudgies remained, however, but something odd happened. The timing of the tales of the monster are a map through the history of the Native American relationship with the European settlers. The death of the five sons lines up with the very first settlers, and the flight of Mushup is told on side of changing of attitudes among new neighbors. The Pukwudgies, always seen in the negative light, became the foot soldiers of the devil, which many explain their modern connection to shadow people. As many Native Americans began to convert to Christianity, their myths evolved, as the Pukwudgies were responsible for the end evil in the village. In the hand of Satan on the tribe, people who spent time in the forest in New England tell you Pukwudgies are not symbols but real horror that still stalk people. They continue to see them, and the world develops around them. The monsters remain unchanged and as dark as ever. Joan was walking her dog through the forest, through the state forest in Freetown, Massachusetts, on a cool Sunday, Saturday morning in April, when he saw the monster. As she and her dog Sid walked down the path, Sid became anxious and strayed a few feet into the woods. Joan followed him in and stopped short. Her dog was lying completely flat in the leaves on a rock 10 feet away with a Pukwudgie. She described him as looking like what you would describe as a troll, 2 feet high, with pale gray skin, hair on his arms and top of his head. Monster seemed to have no clothes, but it was difficult to tell because his stomach was hung over his waist. Almost touching his knees, his eyes were a deep green, and he had a large lips and a long, almost canine nose.
Okay.
Sneezing. Okay. The Pukwudgie stood watching her, staring straight at her with no expression, almost like it was stunned to see her. Joan froze and remembers thinking the air her lawns had been pushed out. Sid finally came to and ran back towards the trail, dragging Joan, who was still holding the leash tightly. Although the host change took less than 30 seconds, it remains with Joan 10 years later. She has not gone back to the forest, but feels that might not be enough. Three times since the event, She has woken up to find a demon looking in on her. It had never attacked her or spoken to her. She had merely seen it looking through her bedroom window, staying just long enough for her to notice him. All three times, she claims that she was fully awake and can move if she had to. Another man in Framingham, Massachusetts, had an experience that forced him to remain away from the woods. Tim was in a forest when he saw a bright orb in front of him. Having investigated the paranormal, he was excited and tried to snap a photo with his digital camera. The ball of light disappeared and reappeared a few feet further into the woods. Tim followed, losing the spirit 12 times before he realized he had traveled more than 30 feet off the path in a thickly wooded area. He became scared and slowly made his way back into the woods, only to find a 2-foot man standing there, walking towards him. He turned and ran, looked back, saw the figure move back into the woods. Tim reported that what he saw had walked upright and had used its arms to push something aside when he fled to the forest. He moved with a slight limp, but like a human. The second time, Tom saw the Pukwudgies a few years later in a parking lot near the same forest. He was listening to the radio at almost a whisper and checking his rear view mirror for the friend he was waiting for when he saw the same small figure of a man. Everything he saw was identical, and the Pukwudgie just stood there watching him. The car turned on by itself and his radio began to get louder. Tim pulled out of the parking lot and took the long way home to try and stop his hands from shaking. Although the monster seemed content to only frighten Joan and Tim, there are still physical attacks happening. Several people have been assaulted, and one person came down with mysterious illness after seeing them in a cemetery in New Hampshire. Another woman suffered scratches on her arm after falling an orb in a forest in Daunton, Massachusetts. The most disturbing recurring attacks might be taking place at the Pukwudgie's favorite hunting ground in the Freetown State Forest. There is a 100-foot cliff overlooking a quarry down as the ledge. There have been many hauntings at this site, but the most frequent experience is an overwhelming feeling to jump to rocks and water below. In the folklore of the Wampanoag, the Pukwudgies were known to lure people to cliffs and push them off to their death. There have been several unexplained suicides at the ledge, often by people who have no signs of depression or mental disease before entering the forest. Ooh, little bastards, aren't they? Oh man, let's have fun. Hey, fun people, watch you. Share with your friends. Y'all have fun. Pop, you creep. Okay. The Dover Demon is a small humanoid reported from Dover, Massachusetts. It was the subject of an intensive scare during the 1970s when multiple witnesses came forward with their sightings. A Dover demon described as looking sort of like the gray variety of an alien, except that it had skin of rosy orange instead of sickly gray. The Dover demon has a large head, a small stick-like body. It can be bipedal, but often travels on all fours or switches back and forth between the two modes of locomotion. It had eyes that glows, sometimes orange, sometimes green. It did not seem to wear any clothing unless the clothing fits tightly and is the same color as its body. Unlike the grays, the Dover Demon does not seem to be associated with the UFOs, as it just wanders around on its own. Cryptozoologists seldom show interest in the Dover Demon. Mainstream cryptozoologists are rarely willing to seriously investigate humanoids other than hairy humanoids. It seems sightings only happened during a short time period. The most claim that sightings have no cease, so the Dover Demon does not seem to be a pressing matter. It makes it depressingly feeling. As our tale began on 10:32 p.m. on our April 21st, and three 17-year-olds, Bill Barlett, Mike Mazzocco, and Andy Brody, are driving north on the Farm Street. Barlett, who's behind the wheel of Volkswagen, spots something creeping along a low wall of loose stones on the left side of the road. At first he thinks the image is a dog or a cat till the headlights shine on it and he realizes it's nothing he's ever seen before. Figure slowly turns its head and stares into the light. It's two large, round, glassy, lilith eyes shining brightly like two orange marbles. Its watermelon-shaped head resting on top of a thin neck is the size of the rest of the body, except for its oversized head. Creature is thin, with long, spindly arms and legs, and large hands and feet. The skin is hairless and peach-colored, and appears to have a rough texture, like wet sandpaper. Barbara subsequently tells cryptologist Lauren Coleman, standing no more than 3.5 to 4 feet tall, the figure is shaped like a baby's body with long arms and legs. Excuse me. It had been making its way along the wall, its long fingers curling around the rocks. When car light surprised it, unfortunately, neither of Barlett's companions sees the creature. The sighting lasts only a few seconds, and before Barlett can speak, the car leaves the scene. Then the creature is gone. Barlett drops his friends off, goes to the Walpot Street home. Visibly upset, he walks through the door, and father asks him what's wrong. Barlett laces his story and later catches Tilly. And later sketches what he has seen. After around midnight, 15-year-old John Baxter leaves his girlfriend Kathy Crone's house at the south end of Miller High Road. Then Baxter starts walking up the street on his way home. Half an hour later, after he was walked about a mile, he observes something approaching him. Because the figure is short, Baxter assumes it's an acquaintance of his M.G. Bluekurt, who lives on the street. John calls out and no response. Baxter and the figure continue to approach each other until finally the latter stops. Baxter then halts as well and asks, "Who is that?" The sky is dark and overcast, and he only sees a shadowy form. Trying to get a better look, Baxter takes one step closer and the figure scurries off to the left. Running down a shallow wooded gully on the opposite bank, as the figure runs, Baxter hears his footsteps on the dry leaves. He follows the figures down the slope, then stops and looks down the gully. There he sees the creature standing in silhouette, about 30 feet away. It feet molded around the top of a rock several feet from a tree. The creature's body remains runs Baxter of a monkey's, except for its dark figure-eight-shaped head. Its eyes to... Oh, fucking... Who wrote this? Okay, two lighter spots in the middle of the head, looking straight at Baxter, who, after a few minutes, began to feel uneasy. Realizing he had never seen such a creature before, and fearing that it might... what it might do next, he backs carefully up the slope. His heart pounding, he then walks very fast down the road to the intersection at Farm Street. There are a couple passing in the car, pick him up, and drive him home. Skeptics usually claim that the Dover demon was simply a lost baby moose, limps under unusual conditions that made it seem like a bizarre humanoid that sometimes went out four legs. People also don't believe that that actually points out that all signs happened during the wrong time of year for a moose that small to exist. And they also point out that Massachusetts is far from normal moose habitat. Even if such an orphan moose had been wandering around so close to populated areas, it seems as if it would have been easily captured.
its exploration power of the baby moose exploration appeals to you, then you would get around the moose objection by substituting a creature that does not actually exist in the area and can be born any time of the year. Okay, calf. An orange-beard orphan calf would be more likely a candidate for such a person than a baby moose. Other suggested explanations include a monkey, a dog, an alien, mutation, or simply a hoax. Other explanations could have been that escapes an illegal pet gibbon. Some species of gibbon have orange babies, white-cheeked gibbons have an orange colored in females. Dover. 29 years later, William Bartlett stands by a story of what he saw on Farm Street at night. It was an eerie, human-like creature, he said. About 4 feet tall, with glowing orange eyes and no nose or mouth, and a watermelon-shaped head. I have no idea what it was, Bartlett, now a 46-year-old artist living in Needham, said in a recent interview. I definitely know I saw something. The Dover demon that Bartlett and two other teenagers reported seeing over a two-day span in April of 1977, has since gathered worldwide attention. Unlike Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, and the Latin American throat sucker, Chupacabra, internet pages are devoted to the Dover demon. You play the game featuring the creature or buy figurines of it far away in Japan. In a lot of ways, it's kind of embarrassing to me, said Bartlett. I definitely saw something. It was definitely weird. I didn't make it up. Sometimes I wish I had. He has made a career as a painter. His work is displayed in galleries on both coasts, but Google search on Bill Bartlett, as he noted, invariably turns up his strange encounter with the unknown. Once his wife, Gwen, browsing a horror section of the bookstore, flipped open an exhibition of monsters. And there was an entry about her husband and Dover demon. It's a thing that's been following me for years, Bartlett said. Not the creature, the story. Sometimes I dread every following getting calls about it. Thank you everyone for listening to this episode of Monsterlands Podcast, Monsterlands of Massachusetts. You can find more episodes at the website at anchor.fm/Monsterlands Podcast. You also can find me on Facebook for the Facebook page at facebook.com/Monsterlands Podcast. You can also find me on Instagram at G1Tanner, Twitter at G1Tanner, or the podcast at Monsterlands P. You can also email me for questions or submit stories or want to be guests on your show, send me an email at monsterlandspodcast@gmail.com. Also remember to share this episode and like it and leave a review on whatever things you want to do. Check out the polls and whatever. I don't know. I just want to play video games or something. Really? Have a good day. And thank you for listening. I'm Tanner. Be legendary. Thank you for listening to this episode of Monster Legend Podcast. And to find more information about Monster Legend Podcast, go to monsterlegendpodcast.com or anchor.fm/Monster Legend Podcast. There you can find all episodes and platforms on which the podcast is on, which you can subscribe to. You also can email me with questions that will be answered on the show. Thank you.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.